Montefiore and Crémieux achieved the release of the Syrian Jews from prison. But then Montefiore did more than that, seeking a public statement that not only cleared these Syrian Jews, but that also attacked the very accusation of the blood libel throughout history. He did what few Jews in the middle of the 19th century would have thought to do. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 150, Moses Montefiore versus the blood libel. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. If one thinks about the grandest, most triumphant moment in the history of the Bevis Marx Synagogue, the oldest Jewish sanctuary in London, one might select March 15, 1841, on which a ceremony of thanksgiving was marked within the edifice. On that day, some of the most significant members of British Jewry gathered at the Bevis Marx Synagogue to celebrate one of its own, who had successfully lobbied on behalf of persecuted Jews in the Middle East. At this ceremony, honor was bestowed on one man, a man who had traveled to the Middle East to speak out on behalf of his fellow Jews, a man who was known for joining his dedication to his faith with his sense of responsibility for his brethren. To this day, the legacy of Moses Montefiore is honored in the synagogue in which he played so strong a role. Though one who does not know where to look will easily miss the most significant way in which his legacy is honored. When one steps into the incredibly ornate inner space of the Bevis Marx Synagogue, one is immediately struck by an aesthetic antinomy of how humble exterior hides the beauty that is within. The exquisite Spanish-Portuguese Synagogue of England is hidden down a small lane. This cherished edifice of Anglo-Jewry sits in a small courtyard off a street now known as Bevis Marx, and from the exterior, it looks utterly insignificant. The unobtrusive appearance of the edifice testifies to the fact that it was built at a time, 1704, when Jews in Britain were insecure about their presence in England. And yet, when one enters within the building, one realizes that one has found one of the jewels of the Jewish world. When the Wall Street Journal's Naomi Schaefer Riley visited Bevis Marx, she was overcome by its beauty and described it in an article and in one passage focused on its most sacred section. Quote, "Perhaps the most marvelous feature of Bevis Marx is the ark where the Torah scrolls are kept. A classical wooden structure, it is painted to resemble marble, with golden ornaments and inlays. The ark is shaped like a building facade, with three sets of doors that seem to beckon one toward the scrolls contained inside. The most elaborate embellishments are reserved for the place where the people of the book keep their book. At the top of the ark, as is traditional, the Ten Commandments are abbreviated. And above them, a smaller but stirring message in Hebrew, 'Know before whom thou standest.' With such a structure," she writes, "it's hard to forget," end quote. But Naomi Schaefer Riley in this article does not make mention of one spot near the ark in the synagogue, one single seat in the sanctuary that uniquely honors one man. And I refer not to the seat set aside for the chacham or sage of the community. Rather, I refer to a seemingly small seat at the front of the synagogue, one which, unlike most, is equipped with armrests. This was the seat of Sir Moses Montefiore, whose life spanned almost the entire 19th century and was a member, supporter, and lay leader of the Bevis Marx Synagogue for most of that time. Till this very day, that seat has a small rope draped across it in order to prevent anyone from sitting in that spot as a way of preserving and honoring the memory of the man who once sat there. It is striking. This is the synagogue of a community that for many centuries hosted some very well-known Sephardic sages from around the world. But the synagogue is first and foremost that of Sir Moses, and his greatest moment of fame occurred soon after his return from the land of Israel that we described yesterday, a moment that highlighted his activism for his people and presaged much more activism that was yet to come. It was in 1840 in Damascus that a Catholic priest in the area, Father Tomasino, had disappeared. One Jew from the community, seized and tortured, had been forced to falsely implicate members of the larger Jewish community in a blood libel, and a number of prominent members of the Damascus Jewish community were arrested and tortured. As the Jewish Encyclopedia, in its entry on the episode, summarizes, 8 Jews, quote, were imprisoned and tortured. Their teeth and beards were pulled out. They were burned and finally tempted with gold to persuade them to confess an imaginary crime, end quote. And we are further told that one of the Jews, Joseph Lagnato, quote, a feeble old man, died under this treatment, end quote. An international Jewish outcry erupted, and the response of Anglo-Jewry was organized at Montefiore's home, and their efforts were supported by the powerful foreign secretary whom we have just met, Lord Palmerston. As Abigail Green writes, quote, Parliament had yet to grant British Jews full equality, but Palmerston's support for the Jews of Damascus and Rhodes was entirely consistent with his zeal in eradicating slavery and his belief in the fundamental morality of Britain's imperial mission, end quote. Thus, with the support of the British government, Moses Montefiore again traveled to the Middle East, journeying first to Egypt to meet with the man who wielded much power over Syria, Mehmed Ali. He traveled along with a French Jewish activist, whose name you will know if you're familiar with the streets in the German colony neighborhood of Jerusalem today, for there is a street named after him, Adolphus Crémieu. Montefiore and Crémieu achieved the release of the Syrian Jews from prison. But then Montefiore did more than that, seeking a public statement that not only cleared these Syrian Jews, but that also attacked the very accusation of the blood libel throughout history. He did what few Jews in the middle of the 19th century would have thought to do. He traveled to Constantinople and demanded from the Sultan a firman, an official declaration. Abigail Green, in her biography of Montefiore, describes what Montefiore achieved working with his travel companion, Louis Lowe. Quote, the final text of the firman more than lived up to Montefiore's expectations. Opening with a categorical denial of the blood libel, the Sultan repeated his promise that Jews would enjoy the same privileges as other peoples living under his authority. Indeed, the document went far beyond the draft version drawn up by Montefiore and Lowe, for the Sultan announced that he had given the most positive orders that the Jewish nation dwelling in all parts of our empire shall be perfectly protected, as well as all other subjects of the Sublime Porte, and that no person shall molest them in any manner whatever, except for a just cause, neither in the free exercise of their religion, nor in that which concerns their safety and tranquility. End quote. We must at this point, I think, put Montefiore's actions in context of his previous activity and dreams that we have discussed. We have seen how the visit by Montefiore to Jerusalem just before this episode inspired his vision of Jews coming to the land of Israel from all over the world, and of Jews farming in the land, of Jews bringing the land to a blossoming state. The firman by the Sultan declaring the rights of Jews throughout the Ottoman Empire would have been seen by Montefiore as essential to his furthering his dreams of a Jewish return. This was another moment in the life of the man whom, as we have always seen, placed the Holy Land at the center of his vision. A man who, as we have seen, rejoiced in the fact that his coat of arms in Britain contained the name Yerushalayim in Hebrew. Upon arriving in England, there was only one place to honor Montefiore's dedication, Bevis Marks. And as Abigail Green tells us, Jews from across London came to the synagogue, including one family that had once belonged to the congregation, but then had left the synagogue, a family that we have met in our episodes. Quote, when Montefiore made his way through the city on March 15, 1841, to attend the special service of thanksgiving in his honor, large crowds gathered outside the gates of Bevis Marks. Heavily built now, and tall enough to stand well above the multitude, he must have cut an impressive figure, proud of his achievements and a hard man to cross. The synagogue yard was packed with children and pensioners, although only a lucky few had tickets, members, their wives, the elite of the Ashkenazi community, Montefiore's Jewish relatives, and his Christian friends. Hundreds of candles illuminated the beautiful Queen Anne building, and all the people who mattered were there. The Rothschilds, Sheriff David Solomons, Isaac Lyon Goldschmidt, even the renegade Disraeli family, which had converted to Christianity 2 decades before. Prayers were read in Hebrew, but specially printed booklets carried a full English translation. End quote. In the 1950s, marking the 250th year of the synagogue, the royal family visited Bevis Marks. The rope was removed, and in the seat of Moses Montefiore sat Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh. 50 years after that, on the 300th anniversary of the synagogue, it was Prime Minister Tony Blair that was allowed to sit there. Montefiore would have approved, I think, for he did see himself as British, but he also believed that his becoming an elite member of British society would never stop him from placing his pride in his faith and his dedication to the well-being of the Jewish people at the heart of his activism. Montefiore never worried that placing his Jewishness at the heart of who he was would prevent him from achieving his place in society and the world. Montefiore's actions bring to mind a metaphor by Cynthia Ozick, cited by Natan Sharansky, about combining particularistic Jewish identity with a dedication to society. Ozick reflected, quote, if you blow in the wide part of the shofar, you will not be heard. But if you start with the narrow part, then the blast will come through the wide part loud and clear, end quote. Today, in the Sephardic Cemetery of Amsterdam, the grave of Menashe ben Israel is restored with a plaque by English Jewry declaring their gratitude to Menashe for lobbying Cromwell in the 1650s to allow the Jewish return to England. The plaque is beautiful and appropriate, but perhaps it is one rope across a chair that expresses gratitude more silently and more eloquently. A chair largely empty for centuries, whose emptiness proclaims a presence. The presence of a man whose journeys by the 1840s were not yet over. A man who would again travel to the Middle East. A man whose further important impacts on Jerusalem are yet to come. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow, wishing you a very joyous Purim, signing off.